On February the 14th, we will have a new member induction into this church. We had a number of people at our inquirers class the other night. Some of those people will decide to be members. If you missed that class and you would like to talk about this church, please call the office in the afternoons, and I will be happy to schedule a meeting with you at your convenience to answer your questions if you think you might wish on February the 14th to become a part of this adventure. If you like happy endings, you won't be as fond of this parable as you were of the one last week when we talked about the workers who came to work late in the day, but because of their employer's amazing grace, got the same reward as those who had started at dawn. Not too late, we could tell ourselves, never too late. And the choir sang Amazing Grace for us, and we all left feeling good about the patience of God and the forgiving generosity with which life often treats us. But a single parable is never the whole truth. And this morning, as we close the January sermons on the parables, we read one that says, sometimes it is too late. A story that opens with the promise of laughter and dancing and ends with the sound of a door slamming shut on five nice girls who are left standing outside the party, deeply disappointed. So what else can the kingdom of heaven be like? Well, sometimes, according to this story, it wears the face of judgment. 10 young women dress up for a wedding, an Eastern wedding celebrated at night to escape the heat. So they trim their lamps and go off to meet the bridegroom, who will come with his friends to bring the bride from her house to his. In our weddings, the bride is the center of interest and may keep us waiting. But in this patriarchal story, it's the groom who sets the pace, and he's late. So late that as the 10 bridesmaids wait on the porch, they get drowsy and begin to nod. The hours have dragged on toward midnight. There's a lot of partying still to come. They reason among themselves that a little rest couldn't hurt anyone. And there will be no criticism in the story of their falling asleep. That's perfectly human. That part was all right. They all had those little oil lamps that looked like a gravy boat, a wick in the spout, sometimes carried on top of a pole. They all had them, and they all went to sleep. The only difference was that five of them had been smart enough to bring extra oil just in case, and the other five hadn't bothered. Just thoughtless, not wicked or mean, just carelessness. Have you ever wondered if carelessness may not cause more trouble in our lives than deliberate malice? That we are just thoughtless more often than we are mean? Finally, at midnight, a cry breaks through their slumber. The bridegroom is coming. Wake up. And five of them discover that their lamps are dying out. Quick, lend us some of your oil. Our lamps are going out. They say to their friends, and the other five girls say, "Sorry, we can't do that. There may not be enough for all of us. You need to go find a dealer and buy for yourselves." A woman said when I taught this parable once, "Wouldn't it have been more Christian for the smart girls to have said, 'Oh, certainly, help yourselves. We love to share.'" But somebody had to be in the wedding party, and this has a ring of practical sense. And besides, this story is being manipulated to make one point, and it will play as fast and loose with logic and love as it has to in order to make that point. So the girls with foresight said no, and the thoughtless girls headed off desperately to find some oil. They have to wake up dealers. Probably a couple won't even answer the door. And by the time they get back with fresh oil in their lamps, the party has started without them. They go up to the door, find it shut, beat on it, yell, "Hoo-ah, we're here." And the harsh judgment of this story hits us again. The Lord of the house says, "I don't know you." And the door stays shut. Some read this as if it were a lesson about the second coming. I think it makes more sense nowadays to say there is such a thing as a moment of destiny, and we need to have gotten ready for it. The trouble is that the moment may be so long coming that we stop thinking about being ready and think only of how tired we are and fall asleep, having lost most of our patience. I like to think that Jesus, who told this story, had already lived it. Think for a moment about what he must have been like to have won the love and loyalty of so many people. Imagine a man with so much intensity and high imagination, his head filled with the poetry of life, his heart on fire to describe the kingdom of right relationships, and then think what it must have been like to work patiently in the carpenter shop all those years. We make a terrible mistake when we let preachers convince us that the life of Jesus was computer programmed, had to run off in a certain way, sort of unrolled automatically like reel off a tape. What was to be would be, everything coming at just the foreordained moment. I was taught that way as a child, to think of the life of Jesus as inevitable, and the result was he wasn't real. He wasn't truly human. Perhaps the best thing that ever happened to me in religion came when I read a book I found one day in a bookstall in a place called Llandudno, North Wales. Just one little book I found quite by accident, in which Jesus of Nazareth became a real person for me for the first time, instead of an infallible God disguised as a person and acting out an elaborate game. A person who went out at night and looked at the stars and wondered about God and the will of God and became convinced after a while that he had something terribly important to say to the world, but when and how? And going home night after night to light another fire under the pot of glue, waiting, 20 years of waiting, and not being resentful and bitter, and not saying after 20 years, well, my life is spoiled now. How can I ever do what I wanted to do? We're all waiting for something more, for the bridegroom to come, living in hope, because there's not much life without hope. We waited as children for that wonderful moment when the squiggles on the page would mean something we could interpret for ourselves, no longer in bondage to our patient mom and dad to read to us, out on our own, the doors opening into a feast of language and ideas, and then waiting again for the first job, the first car, our mate, the birth of our own children, and all those beautiful and terrible things that go with having them. And then getting older, and the kids leaving, and our life's work pretty much behind us, not wanted by as many people as used to want us, and asking ourselves, with time stretching out so strangely empty, what do we wait for now? What meaning is left? But finding some, living in hope, because what else keeps the heart beating? So the parable is about waiting and being ready, and it has a harsh judgment. Sometimes it can get to be too late. You remember the lines from Julius Caesar? There is a tide in the affairs of men which, taken at the flood, leads on to fortune. Omitted, all the voyage of their life is bound in shallows and in misery. Shakespeare knew this morning's parable. And he knew that it can get to be too late. I told you I didn't like this one. I prefer the prodigal son parable about the boy who blows his inheritance on wine, women, and song, has a tough time for a while, then gets smart and comes home and has a huge party thrown for him. No lectures, even from his parents. Do you have any idea, young man, how you've hurt me and your mother? No punishment. Just a happy father who thought he had lost his son, running out with his arms open, saying, "Welcome home, son. Let's have a party." I like that one. But the Bible argues with itself and sees both sides of life. And the sound of the door slamming shut reminds us that there is also in God's lexicon the word no. And life confirms it. When the young man sits for the job interview and hears the word, "Sorry, you lack the training. You are not ready." When a parent looks into the eyes of a grown child he might have spent more time and tenderness on and sees what can't be repaired and a door slams, "Sorry, I really don't know you. It's too late." When my old high school friend, dying of lung cancer, looks up at me from the hospital bed and says, "I always intended to quit smoking so much, but I never got around to it, and now," his voice trails off, he can't make himself say the words, "It's too late." But the doctors had already said it. And now his son and wife are simply waiting, deeply sorry to be robbed of another 10 or 15 good years they might have had. So here is the Bible saying something as incredibly commonplace as the words we say to one another. You have to make yourself ready. You never know when the moment or the challenge will come. There is a lot of patient waiting in life, of slow, quiet preparation for something that is often delayed in coming. 40 years in the desert for Moses, while his people groaned and died under slavery. 40 days in the desert for Christ, after his heart heard a voice at his baptism, and he was on fire to get started. 3 years for Paul out in the Arabian desert, meditating through the hot, silent days and the long nights under the stars, until for each of them, the moment came and found them ready. So it says this, our parable, about the thoughtless girls. And it also says one other important thing, that there are some things that cannot be loaned, cannot be borrowed. If you love someone, you will want more than anything in the world to transfer to them in a moment of crisis your own strength of will, peace of mind, moral fiber. But you can't really do it. Some things do not suddenly or easily transfer. How many of you have sat with a child who is mystified by the doctor and the huge humming hospital, unable to understand what they will do to him, unable to understand how they can wish to be gentle and help him since they are strangers? And you would give anything to transfer your own knowledge and confidence, and you can't do it. In easy times, we assume otherwise. There'll always be somebody to fill our empty oil vessel. I think of the man who lived so long on his father's hard work and integrity, on his mother's goodness and self-sacrifice, on his wife's undeviating loyalty, and looked as much like the rest of us as those five thoughtless girls looked like the other five until his midnight came and the crisis, and he had nothing. No one to borrow from, left in that ultimate loneliness of the person who is forced at last to look inside and discover that no one is at home. It won't matter at such a time that there are friends who would lend their own inner resources if they could, because they can't. So the reply of those five thoughtful girls to the sad extremity of their careless friends may sound smug and selfish. There won't be enough for all of us. Go to those who sell and buy for yourselves. But if you interpret it in terms of life experience, it's not smug. It's simply inevitable. It happens all the time. Here is a careless man who has cheated in a dozen ways every week of his life. No sacrificial integrity, no high nobility, no practice in character. And the moment comes, his life hangs in the balance. He must respond in the right way or the fateful moment passes forever. But how can he do it? Nothing in his life has prepared him. He isn't ready. Standing in the crowd, watching, is a friend who would gladly transfer his own character, make a loan, but it doesn't work that way. Imagine a flippant woman whose reading and conversation have never led her one inch deep into depth of character. Imagine this woman overtaken suddenly by tragic sorrow. She needs strong faith and deep conviction, wisdom learned over a lifetime of thoughtfulness, and she simply does not have it. She calls a friend. She'll borrow someone else's faith in that emergency. It won't work. When the crisis comes at midnight, there is no such thing as getting a quick loan of moral courage. Outside the house, in the darkness, a voice that says, "Keep yourself ready or miss the moment."